item number 10, which is the 11.
Oh, sorry. It automatically numbered it for me. I apologize.
Yeah, Microsoft has a way of thinking they're smarter than we are. Is adoption of the region-wide conditional waiver of the timber and vegetation management plan. I'm going for the last word to finish that sentence. Join staff presentation, please.
Board Chair Horn and fellow board members. I'm Doug Cushman, the chief of the Nonpoint Source Unit and the Timber Program Manager for the Lawn Water Board. I'd like to start by informing you that there are some late revisions and late additions to this item from the proposed that was initially sent to you when you were getting it. You can see both the late revisions and you can set those aside for now. I will discuss them in more detail later in my presentation. Copies of the late revisions and the late additions are in the back of the room for any members of the public that are interested in seeing them. I thank you for considering this item today. It's been an enlightening and engaging process for me and for my staff as we embark on this. I'm here to recommend that you approve this timber waiver for a renewal. It's the fourth one of these. Been in process, in place since 2003 in various iterations. I'd like to briefly outline the issues that my presentation will discuss today, and I will shortly discuss the substantive changes that we propose to make to the timber waiver as we prepare for your consideration. As a reminder, I presented to you in November on staff's intended approach on incorporating improvements in the renewed timber waiver. All the things that are on this slide were done since November and have been incorporated into a revised timber waiver. Modifications to the timber waiver are intended to streamline the permitting process for project implementers and improve Water Board staff's ability to efficiently report on the program's success in protecting water quality within the region. There's been an extensive stakeholder outreach as staff considered how to best incorporate stakeholder and project implementers' concerns into the revised waiver, while also complying with the California Water Code, the Lahontan Basin Plan, and staff resource considerations. The outreach has been ongoing all the way into last week, which is part of the reason that we had the substantial list of revisions on the late revisions that occurred since the proposed was posted publicly. I'll go over those late revisions in a few more moments. The proposed improvements to the timber waiver are outlined on this slide. This is the fourth iteration of the waiver. We believe it has gotten better every time we've brought it in front of the board. I'll outline the improvements that staff and stakeholders have identified as worthy of being included in the revised waiver. The first two items on this slide. For those, staff is proposing to move from a prescriptive approach to a performance outcome-based approach in how we regulate timber harvest activities and vegetation management. This is based on staff professional judgments, feedback from project implementers, and recent pertinent scientific research. I would like the board to be aware that the timber waiver's criteria and conditions of addressing the first two items here are less restrictive than what is contained in the California Forest Practice Rules. The Forest Practice Rules are designed for commercial timber harvest generating lumber off of private lands in California. On public lands, the Forest Practice Rules generally do not apply, and on forested public lands, the approach is moving away from generation of saw logs to a fuel reduction activities to prevent catastrophic wildfires. Although the differences are there, the impacts on the ground and ground disturbance can be similar if projects are poorly planned or implemented. being said, we feel that the forest practice rules have some validity and elements of them would apply, others do not. The revised timber waiver seeks to ensure that enrolled projects have been planned so that implementation in compliance with the timber waiver's conditions will adequately protect water quality while streamlining the regulatory process to not needlessly inhibit project implementation feasibility. As the first item, operable soil conditions were revised. Again, moving from a prescriptive approach to a performance-based approach, the 2009 timber waiver identifies specific ground conditions that must be present and specifies detailed procedures that must be followed before mechanized equipment can be operated off roads within sensitive lands. The current standard includes a requirement for soils to be dry to 12 inches. This has the potential to shorten the non-winter operating season in the spring, summer, and fall. It also is somewhat subjective, or even highly subjective, and can be costly to implement due to the requirement for resource professionals to evaluate soil conditions. The proposed waiver has a performance standard approach that prohibits visible soil deformation that results in ruts that exceed 3 inches in depth at any time, and requires operations to cease if ruts exceed 2 inches for greater than 25 feet in length. That change to a performance-based criteria that mandates that operations halt when surface soil compaction occurs is intended to increase efficiency while preventing water quality degradation. The compaction and rutting standards were determined during literature review and through stakeholder input. The second key change is moving from a prescriptive approach to a performance-based approach regarding slash piling and burning in stream environment zones in the Lake Tahoe Basin. Slash piling and burning in Tahoe Basin SEZs was not allowed prior to adoption of the 2009 timber waiver. That waiver included a prescriptive approach to allowing the practice that focused on pile size and the percentage of an SEZ treatment area to be covered with piles. The waiver was silent on the SEZ response to pile burning. The performance-based approach will be focused on the persistence of burn scars and the vegetative recovery of stream environment zones. Pile burning has the potential to burn up the native seed bank stored in the underlying soil. Excessive soil heating has the further potential to sterilize the soil beneath the slash pile when it is burned. Recent research indicates that post-burning management measures influence the length of time for vegetative recovery of the burn scar and decrease the likelihood of invasive species colonization of the impacted area, the area impacted by pile burning. The 2009 timber waiver also requires that a basin plan prohibition exemption be granted outside of the timber waiver enrollment process. The Water Board adopted the 2009 timber waiver with this requirement because the activity had previously not been allowed and there was limited research on burn pile impacts in these areas. CEQA compliance is required any time a basin plan prohibition is granted. This was done on a project-level basis for the last 5 years. The CEQA document that was certified by the Water Board in 2009 included a description of project design features that should be considered for incorporation into slash piling and burning projects to ensure no significant environmental impacts occur. These project design features were included in all projects that were granted a basin plan prohibition exemption during the tenure of the 2009 waiver. A CEQA addendum was prepared for this iteration of the timber waiver that addresses waiver revisions and updates the project design features for slash piling and burning in SEZs. The Water Board must consider the CEQA addendum during the timber waiver renewal process, but no new CEQA certification is required. The updated timber waiver incorporates the CEQA addendum identified measures into the timber waiver application process and grants basin plan prohibition exemptions during project enrollment. This will significantly improve Water Board utilization of staff resources and also provide project implementers and the public an increased level of certainty of what requirements are associated with pile burning in Tahoe Basin SEZs. The timber waiver proposes two options to address burn scar impacts. Option one involves burning, slash piling generally cure for at least 2 years to ensure dry fuels that will be fully combusted and limit the smoke generated during this activity. Regardless of the option chosen, by the end of the second growing season, after pile burning, all burn scars must either exhibit vegetative recovery or have been raked with native duff or organic mulch and seed to a specified coverage. The third key change to the timber waiver is to update the monitoring and reporting program. The 2009 timber waiver allowed for waiver enrollees to submit required monitoring information using the Water Board adopted monitoring forms or in a different format that provided the similar information. Staff review of different monitoring formats, monitoring reporting formats, and submittal dates has not been an efficient use of program resources. Additionally, legislation was passed and incorporated began in 2013 that also requires project-level reporting to the California legislature for forest activity regulation. That's Assembly Bill 1492. This stipulates that a 1% tax or fee be applied to retail sale of lumber. It funds the statewide forest activities regulatory program for our agency and three other agencies, California Fish and Wildlife, Cal Fire, and California Geological Survey. The timber waiver application and monitoring and reporting program forms were revised. To best capture the information that is required and needed to ensure that water quality impacts are not occurring and to allow staff better focus on those projects where field presence is most relevant. It is also hoped that the information gained through the renewed timber waiver will facilitate continued streamlining of the regulatory process for a future timber waiver. This waiver will last for 5 years. After the Water Board approves the timber waiver, the monitoring forms will be converted to an electronic format that can be submitted through the internet as the board transitions to a paperless office and electronic reporting pack. As we engaged in this since November and prior during the last 5 years, stakeholder concerns have been brought to our attention. Concerns were raised that water quality impacts can occur despite compliance with category-specific waiver conditions. Staff has modified the proposed waiver to include reference in each category, in each waiver category, to the general conditions. General condition 2, which was in the previous waiver and is also still unchanged in the current waiver, but is more explicitly referenced in each waiver category, stipulates that unauthorized discharges or potential discharges of waste to surface waters are not allowed. I've also discussed the timber waiver's two options to ameliorate burn scars. This approach will allow project implementers greater flexibility in addressing burn scar impacts. The proposed timber waiver also includes requirement to monitor for invasive species colonization of burn scars and to provide the Water Board with a corrective action plan and implementation schedule should invasive species be observed. Burn scars that do not exhibit vegetative recovery must be covered with native duff or mulch and seed to inhibit invasive species colonization of the scars. This requirement applies to Category 6 SEZ pile burning activities. The research is clear that this is a good inhibitive measure to prevent invasive species. No additional reporting deadlines have been imposed under the proposed new waiver. The proposed timber waiver requires monitoring reports submitted twice a year, in January after the previous season's activities, and again in July after the rain or snowmelt season has occurred. Enrollment and monitoring forms were modified to best address issues relevant to water quality protection as pertains to vegetation management activities. is a busy slide, violates everything I've ever been told about PowerPoint. However, if you go to your late editions page, on Bates page 11267, there's a copy of this that is far more legible. Page 11268 has another form of similar, another example. This is an example of a section of the timber waiver application, and I'll give everybody a little time to get there. As I said, we updated our forms to best capture the information we feel is relevant and pertinent to water quality protection related to vegetation management activities. The black type on this slide is pulled directly from the application form. The green type illustrates an example answer that is intended, that has been created to illustrate the forms that have been created to ask relevant questions that shall be answered in a checkbox or short answer narrative format. This is an example of the relative level of detail that we would anticipate to be included in these forms. As I stated, page 11268 is an example of the monitoring form and the questions associated with that. I do not have a slide for that. I put one busy slide just plenty for everybody. That concludes my presentation. However, it does not include my presentation. I'm sorry. The late edition of that you see has enclosures 5, 6, 7, and 8. You've just been looking at a portion of enclosure 7, the example forms. Enclosure 5 is two public comment letters that were received after the posting of the proposed timber waiver and staff responses to those comments. Enclosure 6 is a summary of the changes to the 2009 waiver into the proposed and revised timber waiver by the requesting party. I said enclosure 7 is the examples of the two forms. And enclosure 8 is a letter of support for the 2014 timber waiver as revised from the U.S. Forest Service Regional Forester in Vallejo. I'm also happy to go over the late revisions packet and the reasoning behind those revisions if any board members would like to hear that.
Why don't we see if any questions come up about them? Makes sense.
With that, I will now conclude my presentation and provide the board with a staff recommendation that the proposed timber waiver with late revisions be adopted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Richmond. Thank you. Mr. Sandell, do you have any questions for Mr. Richmond?
I do not, thank you.
Ms. Cox? Mr. Dagny? Mr. Humphrey?
No.
I would like to understand a little bit more. Well, first of all, I want to make a general comment, which is I appreciate the hard work that everyone has put into revising the timber waiver and how thoughtful people have been in trying to improve the timber waiver. In general, I really believe that the outcome-based approach is the right way to go. Because what that does is it gives implementers the chance to continually improve the processes. If you're dictating use only this kind of machinery, then it prevents people from experimenting to see if another kind of machinery might work better. So I think the outcome-based approach is, I'm really in favor of that way of going. I also want everyone in the room to know, if you don't know already, that I am a forester and I've spent a lot of time in the field with a paint gun. So, not a handgun, a paint gun. really not a handgun. and my personal belief is that there's no inherent conflict between taking good care of the forest and maintaining water quality. And as everyone who's read Gifford Pinchot knows, The origin of the Forest Service was to protect watersheds in the first place. That was one of the main driving points for having the Forest Service. So I really believe that this is an area where we really can come together and come up with ways of approaching these issues that satisfies everybody. I would like to understand a little more about the soil operability changes. I just want to understand how that's going to work. Is there going to be somebody walking behind the heavy machinery? Just explain to me how somebody on a piece of machinery is going to know when they have exceeded the limits stated in the timber waiver.
A general approach from our agency is to rely on project implementers to comply with the terms of policy. We are understaffed to be able to go out and monitor every single project or have a field presence at all times. We rely on project implementers to comply. With regard to how that works, we anticipate that the equipment operator will know, just as you do when you're driving, if things get a little slick and squirrely, you can tell immediately. If you're driving a piece of, even a heavy piece of equipment, you should have some level of perception of what the ground is like. One, it's the middle of July and it hasn't rained in 5 months, or 3 months, or 2 months. That's a good indicator. Also, just the sponginess of the ground. If that's going on, you've probably got a problem and you should be very cautious about what you're doing and looking to see what the impacts from the equipment are as you're working. As you said, you spent lots of time in the woods. You have a fairly reasoned approach and perception of what's going on when you're out walking around in the woods. Timber operators also have spent significant amounts of time in their life in the woods, didn't likely get into that activity because they really are urbanites. They're forest environment people. They work in the forest. They have a perception of what's going on around them. On another level, there is generally, either through the forest practice rules on private land for commercial operations, or on U.S. forest land, or BLM land, there's a contracting officer's representative that is out on site and should be there with some great regularity to oversee the contractor that's doing the work. And Forest Service contracts have provisions within them for the operator, the contracted employee that's conducting the work, to comply with the conditions, with some level of enforcement from the Forest Service to oversee and self-regulate that activity. We've also gone to the monitoring forms updates that require project-specific monitoring and reporting on all projects. That should ensure that somewhere somebody has to certify that activities have been conducted in compliance with the timber waiver. Did I adequately answer your question?
Pretty well. I'm just wondering, as the experiences you've had with the 2009 waiver, has that given you confidence that this outcome-based approach is going to work?
For the very most part, yes. There are limited occasions where we have seen things go a little beyond what was intended or stipulated in the waiver. To the level we've been able to, we have been on top of that. And through either staff enforcement or, as needed, progressive enforcement, have indicated to enrollees that we are serious about this and that if there is non-compliance, there will be ramifications associated with that. So there have been limited interactions under the 2009 waiver.
Right.
I think it's unrealistic to expect 100% compliance, but we feel that we have the tool. If non-compliance is there, we can take it into the Water Board's enforcement realm.
Right. Okay. Anyone who wants to submit a comment card, if you have, can educate me more about this issue, I would love to hear what you have to say. Any other questions for Mr. Cushing? Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'd like to call Barry Hill.
Uh, Good morning, Chairman Horn and members of the board, and thank you again for the opportunity. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay, great. Okay, well, I'd like to start off thanking Doug for his presentation, and I'd like to point out that, as Amy stated, the Regional Board and the Forest Service, we do have somewhat different missions, but we do share common goals for protection of communities, forest health, and water quality. So I think that's important to realize that we do have that in common. The main concern of the Forest Service in our region, which is the state of California, is to increase the pace and scale of forest restoration, primarily to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfires. And I think it's important to realize, as Doug mentioned, we don't operate under the California Forest Practice Rules, and there is a significant difference in the type of work we do, because on the economic forestry side, the goal is really to get the wood out. And when we're looking at forest health restoration, there's a definite need to go into riparian areas and treat those fuels. And that need is not there on the private side. They're there to get the wood, and in general, they can leave the riparian zones alone. We don't really have that option. We have to be working in the riparian zones. Obviously, that's where the potential for impacts to water quality are higher. And so we understand that there has to be regulations that apply to that, but I do want to point out that that's necessary for us to do that. So we have worked with your staff extensively, I would say, on this waiver as we did in 2009, and we don't feel that the proposed waiver is perfect. We plan to continue working with staff on some changes looking toward 2019, although I may not be here representing the Forest Service by then. But we do feel that the proposed waiver substantially improves upon the 2009 waiver by removing some of the requirements for board approval of the basin plan prohibition exemptions and replacing some of the prescriptive requirements with the performance-based standards that Doug mentioned. So we do feel that the 2014 waiver, as it's currently proposed, will allow the Forest Service to increase the pace and scale of our restoration efforts. And our regional forester, Randy Moore, has provided a letter of support to that effect, and I think you've seen the letter, but if I may, I'd just like to read a short paragraph from that. Quote, I am confident the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board 2014 timber waiver, when finalized, will allow the U.S. Forest Service to maintain or improve the pace of scale ecological restoration on national forest system lands while protecting water quality. Two very much appreciated changes of the replacement of prescriptive waiver conditions with performance-based standards and the elimination of requirements for board approval for most basin plan exemptions. So our regional forester understands that there are risks involved with providing a letter of this nature, but he feels that these risks are acceptable based on the leadership of your board staff that has worked to make our support possible for this. So we'd like to thank your staff, in particular your executive officer and your division manager, Doug Smith, as well as Doug Cushman, for helping us to reach that point. I think it's highly likely that issues will continue to arise, and we're going to be relying on your leadership to help us work through these issues that will allow us to continue to maintain that pace and scale of restoration that I think we all agree is needed. So in conclusion, we look forward to continuing to work together with your staff, and I'd like to thank the board and the staff for preparing this waiver, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Hill? Thank you. The next comment card I have is from Nancy Gibson.
Good morning, Chair and members of the board. I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you this morning relative to the 2014 timber waiver. Barry mentioned quite a bit of what I would mention as well, and that is my profound appreciation for the collaborative approach that has been taken in moving the dialogue forward in this waiver renewal. I think a lot of what we do is relative to not only the protection of water quality that I think we're all very well behind, but it's also the protection of communities and the fact, and you'll hear the phrase several times, you know, increasing pace and scale for ecological restoration to prevent catastrophic wildfire. And it's this latter piece where the rubber hits the road for me. And I'm a little fire-centric these days because the last 3 weeks of my time I have been spending getting briefed, rebriefed, and tooled up for what is anticipated to be a very, very significant fire season this year. And one of the resources that I call back to quite frequently is the work in the business and psychological community on managing risk. This is called managing the unexpected. And when we look at managing risk, we look at the stakeholders and the players who influence outcomes. And because we're talking about a timber waiver where we have now pushed the mold a little bit toward outcome-based measurements, which I think is an outstanding way to go, we need to continue pressing for that outcome-based measure because, again, in sharing risk, we as stakeholders and participants in this process, we mutually share several things. We share the fact that as we go about our projects implementing what is being defined through the timber waiver, somewhat outcomes-based, somewhat prescriptive in some cases, we are both accepting the risk that it's going to get us that outcome of water quality that we're anticipating. So we're all in this together. There's another component to that, which is the cost risk. And in the nature of the burn piles, which tends to be a pretty active engagement issue, the burn piles, what we're talking about is potential for a fourth entry in what is already the highest cost fuel management process. And so one of the things that I see we could have a vision for stretching in the future in any outcome-based measure is really stretching in that concept of mechanized use in riparian areas. Because we're not stretching quite as far as I think we have capability to, and maybe it is the 2019 waiver, or maybe we'll have some learnings in the next couple of years that influence an amendment sooner than that. But we have significant areas within the public lands jurisdiction where I can't even send people to do hand piling. I can't even send people because the risks and safety issues are so predominant that I simply cannot do any action in those high fuel-loaded areas. And so because mechanized is actually the more effective because it's a single entry process, you go in, you have protection based on the mechanized equipment that you're using. There are protections to the workforce. It's not a hand thinning kind of thing. And you're in, you treat the fuels, you remove them. It's typically biomass because it's very degraded quality fuels, and it gets shipped away. So you have a one entry, single treatment, it gets moved out of the basin, and there's no burning, nothing else goes with it. And today we have much more sophisticated equipment that would allow us to do that. Now that's not part of anything of the waiver today, but that's a vision of stretching us a little further to some outcome-based measures, because that will be the most cost-effective way to treat lands that are flat enough. You know, we have other criteria for that. What we have with our burn piles, again, is the most expensive application. It's the most risk-based application because it's people going in with chainsaws, with overstory that's dead and dying. They're working on removing this, and they enter and they cut. Then they enter and they pile the slash. And then we wait a few years, and then we enter again to apply the fire to the landscape. And now we would enter a fourth time, which we haven't done up until this period, in some of the monitoring, raking, that kind of thing. And from a perspective of just quantity, we can have an acre of fuel reduction that's 50 to 100 piles. You treat 50 acres, how many piles? How much more risk are you exposing your workforce to for that fourth entry should raking be required or necessary? Now, the good thing is we've been under the 2009 waiver. We have treated thousands and thousands of acres and thousands of piles, and we haven't had ill results from that. And so I have every expectation we're going to have satisfactory regen in our burn piles that won't require that fourth entry with raking. So that my optimism is very high that we won't have to pick that option, because it won't be an option we can afford. And so I am also working on some very finite funding. A couple of years ago, we went before the board. We got the permitted process for a South Shore 10,000-acre fuel reduction project. Those are time-limited funds. And we started that process, but the whole planning process, it went on for quite a while. In my latest conversations with the BLM folks that hold the purse strings to those funds, we've been given an extension to 2016, I believe it is. That's not enough time. We asked for a 5-year extension. We were given 2. And we were asked to prove to us you can accomplish as many acres as possible before we look at whether or not we'll extend you beyond that 2 years. And so I'm going to have to really look at where I can get the most activity performed with the least cost to be as aggressive as possible to prove that we can reduce fuels in the communities of South Lake Tahoe in a way that builds that confidence that we can be supported in that extension beyond 2016. If we don't, we give the money back. And so, again, I'm going to really have to look at pace and scale internally for our ability to have multiple entries on units that have burn piles that are in riparian areas. Maybe I go to the least cost options first, which would be outside of riparian areas. We do have high risk in riparian areas, so we would be really timing things for that 15%. You know, we have 15% we can enter in piles we can burn. We have to wait 2 years for the recovery, so we can't go back in that. So then I'm in the uplands to work on that. And then if the recovery is good in the riparian areas for the revegetation, then we can go back 2 years hence. You know, it's a real timing issue that I will be having to work out, and that's fine, because I believe we're pursuing the appropriate means of holistic fuels reduction and natural resource management. We are getting closer to that pace and scale that the regional forester addresses in ecological restoration. And we want to continue moving forward with those outcome-based measures, because I think really that's where we're going to have to be. We all work with finite funds. When the money that I am working off of now goes away, I still have opportunity to compete, you know, internally for appropriated funds. And I think we're in a much better place in showing how our relationship with compliance and our regulators and those kinds of things are providing us what we need to show appropriate, efficient use of the funding we get for accomplishing what we need in fuels reduction on the ground. So those really are the gist of my comments. I have with me today my forester, Duncan Leo. He's been intimate in many of the discussions that we've had with the Lahontan staff. I really appreciate the time and energy that Doug Cushman, Doug Smith, and others have spent in getting us to this place. I think it's a it's a very well-received and positive place to be to move forward. And I would only say that I think we have other things we can work through as we go through these some of these new requirements to assess where we are. We will continue with dialogue, because I think that's the most fruitful way to get to clear understanding. And I really hope that over time we can really think dramatically about how to treat the hazardous fuels in riparian areas where it is unsafe to do so by the workforce that we have. The people way to do it, you know, you always have people, but there are certain areas in our jurisdiction that are going to require some alternative approaches to the fuel reduction loads there. Thank you for your time, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do you have any questions, Mr. Sandell?
No, thank you.
Ms. Cox? Mr. Jardine? Mr. Pumphrey?
All right, thank you.
I haven't had mine on.
I'm sorry.
People keep trying to do this to me. First of all, I really appreciate the sentiments you expressed this morning of continually improving our process and working together and having dialogue. That's definitely the right way to go. And I also appreciate you explaining what it looks like from your position. It really helps us to understand your perspective. And this is a challenge to, hit the right balance. And it's particularly a challenge because we're playing catch-up out there in the woods. I mean, some of the places out there, Meeks Creek and behind Grand Lamacan, they're pretty scary, I have to say. I would like to know more about these areas that are unsafe to work in, where they are, what they look like. Just knowing where they are so I could go and look at them sometime would be helpful.
Actually, Patty and I have walked along Saxon Creek.
Okay.
And it's relatively level land. Saxon Creek runs through it. Oneidas Creek we actually treated through our South Shore project. We treated a number of acres in that Oneidas Creek trailhead or Oneidas trailhead area. Mm-hmm. But this, because it required hand activities in this hazardous watercourse of Saxon Creek, we looked at it and we said we just can't send people there, and so we dropped the unit. If you follow down the trail that goes parallel to Saxon Creek and through the dead and down that's through there, it wicks right into Chibcha, which is from that neighborhood on, there's about 200 homes. So, you know, my greatest fear, fire will take the, I would say the course of least resistance, but it's really the course of easy fuel.
Right.
And because you have a major public recreation area on one side and the opportunity for fire to wick up through Saxon Creek into the neighborhood, it's really an angora repeated. Oops, sorry. And that's not the only area, but that's one that's easy to get to, and I'd be happy to even take the board at lunch today if you'd like to do that, because it's accessible. But that is one that is significant and fresh in my mind for an area that we would not send crews. I mean, basically, I say when I send my son and daughter with a chainsaw in that area, there is no way I would.
I actually some pictures.
Yes,
I took on a walk. I'm technologically incompetent to figure how we can get it from my iPhone to the screen, but I did the pictures.
We do have the option for, we've talked about in the past of giving exemptions for research projects, right?
That is still in the waiver.
Still in the waiver. So, I mean, that's something to think about, is to maybe work that, to try to demonstrate a different technology in an area like this as a research project.
Yeah, we did, and maybe Duncan can shed some light on this. We had the Heavenly Valley demonstration project, which was mechanized equipment in a riparian area, and it proved effective. Mm-hmm. And so, but where you go from that, you know, how do you get from where we have a demonstration project that proved effective to language in a waiver that allows that? That's maybe something that we could put more energy into.
But what's the next demonstration project to do that gets you a little further? That's the question.
Or how many do you need before you have the answer?
Well, if you're talking about some a different kind of technology or a different kind of situations, you know, let's try it and see.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and even in the industry of the mechanized equipment, that is improving leaps and bounds
sure.
every single year. So I would imagine the equipment used at Heavenly would be, you know, maybe not even as good as what's available now, because I think it was like a 5 or 6 year project, 5 or 6 years ago. So
I would add into that to suggest that the equipment that we have today.
Just identify yourself.
Excuse me. My name is Duncan Lael. Thank you for having me in front of your meeting. I would suggest to look into the future. A lot of equipment that we have today, the conventional logging equipment, is far improved in technology, efficiency for the operator, and efficiency in terms of impacts to the ground. Conventional logging equipment has been shown in places like the Lassen National Forest to do fuels treatment in aspen areas with little to no impact at all on water quality and vegetation. That might be something to look at for Lake Tahoe. I believe there was at least a 10-year long-term study regarding that aspen restoration on the Lassen National Forest, where impacts to water quality, sediment, vegetative recovery, macroinvertebrates, and I believe other resources were assessed, and there was no significant impact in that situation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Next we have Steve to share. Yeah.
May I respond briefly to some of the comments?
I'm sorry.
Dr. Horn and board chair and board members, I'd like to clarify that based on those comments, yes, very much acknowledge we have been working well together. The Heavenly Valley Project was incorporated, was considered during adoption of the 2009 waiver. And that waiver allowed mechanized equipment into these sensitive areas. That continues to be allowed. So there is no restriction on mechanized equipment. There are limited restrictions on the use of mechanized equipment in these riparian areas going back 5 years. Continues to be allowed under the timber waiver. The restrictions are not, like the Saxon Creek area, for instance, that's flat ground. They could take mechanized equipment in there. And that continues to be allowed under the proposed waiver.
Did you hear that?
I did.
cut to length.
It is cut to length equipment. Okay. That is the demonstration project that was done. So you referenced, is there an allowance for demonstration projects? There is. That has not been taken advantage of beyond the cut-to-length equipment in the Heavenly Valley Creek area.
So where conditions are similar to the Heavenly Creek demonstration area, that technology could be used again, proposed again?
Correct.
Correct.
And we are supportive of any demonstration projects to go there.
So it's not a new demonstration area. It's been demonstrated that it can be done.
And based on that, that was in 2007 and 2008. The results of that were incorporated into the 2009 waiver.
That makes sense. So you don't need to prove it again. We're not asking you to do replicate experiments.
Right.
Okay. And just as a general concept, there has been, yes, the fuel load out there is tremendous.
Yes.
It is the result of 100 years of fire suppression.
Yes.
It's hard to catch up in one year or one entry, perhaps even. It's moving that way.
Yes.
The Forest Service, the shift from getting the cut out or getting the wood out, as Barry Hill referenced, has really been in this millennium. Since year 2000, there's been a tremendous shift of getting to fuel reduction instead of saw log production off the national forests. The approach to riparian area treatments, That's been slow to catch up with the shift to fuel reduction.
Right.
So the practice is in front of the science on this at this time. It's been very recent that the fuel reduction in riparian areas has even been on the agenda. So is the Tahoe Basin the appropriate place to really further that? That's a question.
Tahoe Basin receives a tremendous amount of funding. So, it, relative to other areas, I do not mean to imply that there's an endless bucket of money. But that is absolutely not true. The work significantly exceeds the resources to put it into place. The monitoring that we are proposing is about as bare bones as we feel comfortable with to move into a new approach of treating riparian areas. We're hopeful that the results and the knowledge that will be gained through this implementation of revised treatments of burn piling and pile burning and monitoring will lead us to a place where we can move forward. So we have been moving forward going back the last 5 years. We hope to keep continue to move forward. There is a notion that Tahoe is a very special place. It's an outstanding natural resource water. Enhanced mitigation measures are required by or suggested by the US EPA. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Teixeira.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, staff, ladies and gentlemen. For the record, my name is Steve Teixeira. My company is Sustainable Community Advocates, and I'm here this morning before you on behalf of the Tahoe Basin Fire Chiefs, the local fire chiefs of local districts and departments. And we want to add our commendations to Mr. Cushman for his significant outreach and collaboration in working through all the issues. We know he's supported in that approach by this board and your management team, so we appreciate that. We're involved in updating the 10-year strategy right now for the Tahoe Basin, and the districts are also updating their local community wildfire protection plans. So as has been indicated by the testimony and the discussion to date, the collaboration needs to continue. Changes continue to occur in the watershed, technology changes, so we look forward to continuing the collaboration with you. We appreciate the comments in detail that the Forest Service and their foresters and hydrologists have made today. I think that's an important part of the record. So we had one specific request that we sent in recently in a letter from the Basin Chiefs dated March 18th, and we appreciate the fact that Mr. Cushman added those into the late changes and certainly support this board's affirmative action on the timber waiver and the changes that are being recommended by staff. So thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Teixeira? Thank you.
Thanks.
And then we have Dave Robinson and Joe Robinson, who have requested in advance a 15-minute PowerPoint, so you know they have, they get along. Oh, while you're setting up, we're going to take a 5-minute break. I apologize. So I think we can get started again.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson and board members. I'm Dave Robinson, speaking for myself as a Tahoe resident, resident of Echo Lakes, and speaking also for ELEF, which is Echo Lakes Environment Fund. There's a sheet of our history that may have been distributed to you earlier. Mm-hmm. Just if you haven't seen that, I'll just briefly touch on it. We've been around for 45 years. It's a nonprofit organization, 501c3. Probably in the last 45 years, we've cooperated with at least 15 agencies in the area in projects that have to do with basically community benefit, cleaning up debris in the Constellation Wilderness and educational process, things like that. We've been commenting on the development of the timber waiver for several months and are really encouraged by not just the response from Water Board staff, but also basically the development of the timber waiver itself and how it has so many references, sometimes from a little bit different perspective, all pointing at basically staff latitude to deal with water quality on the ground. In other words, not just a prescription to perform in a certain way, but an outcome-based perspective. And so our purpose today here, I'm just going to do this as kind of an introduction. My wife has a photo and video presentation to show you in a few minutes, which will speak specifically to conditions that we feel are significant at Echo Lake. We're going to talk specifically about the Echo Lake's fuel reduction project being undertaken by the Forest Service recently. And we hope to demonstrate what we believe to be possibly non-compliant or marginally compliant conditions, not to place blame or ask for any kind of recourse on that, but to our purpose basically is to suggest practical alternatives to burning those piles in there, primarily because the soil conditions, the substrate of granite really is, I don't think, conducive to any kind of filtering action from a soil mantle adequate to absorb nutrient waste and sediment byproducts of combustion. So we've been researching alternatives to pile burning that would be practical in the sense of not overburdening the Forest Service with extra costs. We've spoken with several agencies around the area, and we're partway through this development. My wife will speak more pointedly to that. I want to respond to, we also appreciate Water Board's being so receptive to our comments on the timber waiver as it's gone along. There's one item I'd like to clarify, and this is a letter from ELEF to the Water Board in this last phase of commenting on the proposed waiver. And our letter is talking about trying to avoid burning the slash piles in situ up there at Echo, and Water Board's response contains a sentence which says, the scope of activities allowed under the timber waiver is aligned with present and historic resource management and land use practices in the area. That's true, except for one major point, and that is that there has not been any use of prescribed fire for forest management at all in that area. And so we feel that if that were to happen, we would have a unique set of damages owing to the nutrient-rich and sediment-rich runoff that would happen from those. I'll let my wife speak now. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for the opportunity to express our concern.
Hi, I'm Joe Robinson, and this picture is of Lower Echo Lake. This is the area that is being is under the Upper Echo Lake's Fuel Reduction Project 9, Category 2. In the timber waiver, it says the Water Board finds activities that comply with the criteria and conditions for Category 2 do not pose a significant threat to water quality. And Lahan also states the timber waiver is consistent with basin plan and is in the public interest as described below. Compliance with the conditions of the timber waiver will result in protection of water quality. And that's what we are concerned about. Okay. This is a video that I'm going to show you. This is a feeder stream at Lower Echo Lake. Right now, the water is down 6 feet. It's at its lowest level. So right up in here is where the water is normally, 6 feet up. So we took this in the fall, and these photos were only taken for our own purpose. We didn't mean to make a presentation out of them, so I hope, you know, they aren't the greatest, but I just wanted you to get an idea. So I'll show you I'll start the video.
Let's see if I can advance it. There we go. It's going
up. Okay. So I'm just walking up the stream bed, and as you can see, the water level is normally here. This is firewood that has been by pet trees. You can see that the root systems, look at this tree cut right here, that tree's root system is what holds this bank in. And all along this creek that is extremely active most of the year, there have been trees continually cut right up next to the bank. And here's the water level is right there. So another tree cut right there. Another tree cut. Look at the erosion that does take place underneath. Right here, tree cut. And so this has this is a huge concern for us. Because the soil mantle is historically held in place by the root systems of trees that have been cut, the roots are going to rot, and it's going to cause erosion. That's just, it's a pretty simple thing to see. And Lahontan, under conditions, it says, activities must not cause or create erosion, destabilization of stream banks. And obviously, this forest then has. This is the western shore of Lower Echo Lake. The high water line is right here. Remember that the water is 6 feet out. Usually you have about 4 inches from the top of the pier to the bottom. This is a splash pile here. Here's some sawdust. You can see we have granite here, very, very thin soil. When this splash pile is burned, it's going to go directly into the water. Same with the sawdust, with the snow melt up there. We get a lot more snow up there than we do at Lake Tahoe. And it just rushes down into the water. And so all of us up there have been so careful with water quality. We have done testing for years. And we have such pure water. And we're just extremely upset about what the result is going to be of this burning. And also, under the general conditions, Lahontan states, including but not limited to soil, silt, sand, fill trees, slash sawdust, must not be discharged to surface waters or be deposited in locations where such material may discharge to surface waters. And this is going to discharge to surface waters. This is Lower Echo. This is a slash pile. This is a, as you can see, there's a slope to this granite right here. In the spring, and there's a wood pile right here. In the spring, this is full, it's like a little spring. This goes right down here, right into the lake, and then this is where the water level is. So there's another slash pile ready to go. Even though this is a distance from a lake, it takes, when you start talking about how many feet from a water source or things like that, you also have to consider what the soil conditions are, the depth of the soil, or if it's just a granite slab. And so this becomes a stream in the spring. This, the Forest Service said that they would not burn near glacial polish. This is glacial polish right here. Here's a slash pile. Right there is the water level. And again, right into the lake. You can even tell the water level here by the pier. Okay. This is another slash pile. This is a very steep slope with glacial, it has runoff here. And we're just showing again, this is the femoral stream. The slash pile is located. You can see this is where the water comes down. And look how close the slash pile is. So sure, this is in November, so it doesn't have water coming down. But this will be gushing. It's probably restarting right now as the snow melts.
This is Dyer Cove, and it's the northeast section of Upper Echo. This boat here is 12 feet long. This is a pier right there. This gives you an idea of how close the slash pile is to this cove right here. When, and look at the slope here. When this is burned, it's going to go right in. There's hardly any soil here. It's mainly rocky. And also it says that you have to be 100 feet for a Class 1 water body, which this is, and on a slope of 30 to 50%, and if it's a 50 or more percent slope, it has to be 150 feet. So I have a little video.
See if I can get it to play. There you go.
And this is that same area. There's the boat. There's that slash pile I took a picture of. But look at all the other slash piles. And look, is that going to absorb nutrients from the burn? I don't think so. That's going right in the lake. Okay. This is another picture of a slash pile. This is a bench on somebody's dock. Again, look at the how close that is to the water. This here is a photo of a vernal pool, and this is a springtime pool. This is the watermark right here, and it goes up here, up there, and on down. These pine cones right here are when the pool tends to dry up. It starts leaving these pine cones. They're under this timber waiver in which the Forest Service did this thinning. This is not allowed in a vernal pool, which is the SEC, and neither is the stacking of wood. And then Lahant Naso says there is to be no placement or burning of piles with stream environment zones. And here we go. This is a slash pile. You can see it's not going to be absorbed very well going into the lake here, and that lake is 6 feet down. This is my husband, Dave, that you just met. According to the timber waiver, when this was cut, you are not allowed to have a slash pile higher than 5 feet. My husband is 6 feet, and there's a slash pile up there. So that's another violation. This is right off South Upper Truckee. The Truckee River is right here. This is an active stream right now. In fact, it's even going a lot faster right now. This slash pile is about 4 feet, and look how close it is to the stream. This drains right into the Truckee River. I really hope, if you have time, that you guys take a car ride and go up to the South Upper Truckee Road. You will see a meadow even on the other side. I'm surprised that you're allowed to have slash piles in meadows. And then if you continue up the road, it goes to 89. It becomes a winding road, and it's a pretty steep incline there, and there's slash piles everywhere. And there's creeks coming down that go into the Truckee River. And, I mean, it's obvious what's going to happen. You're going to have a lot of organic material going into the river. And what happens with Echo, too, one reason we're concerned is Echo drains into Echo Creek, which goes into the Truckee River, which goes into Lake Tahoe, and there is so much concern about the clarity of Lake Tahoe. And we feel devoted to try to make that happen and for those goals to be met. Another thing, just so you know, that's happened with this project is there was supposed to be a written agreement with the Forest Service in which both Nancy Gibson and the president of the Echo Lakes Association, which is a homeowners association, they came to an agreement that they would have a written agreement signed before they went in and started doing fuels reduction. That agreement was never signed. And Greg called Nancy Gibson up and asked her to cease the thinning, and it continued. And it continued into November 18th. They were still up there thinning. And they had a phone conversation on the 14th. And then we also think, when we're talking about how many feet from water sources, there's a difference in how the soil is. If it's granite, 150 feet of granite is not going to absorb the burning of a pile. So what we have is, we would like everything to stop up at Echo. And we've had problems getting that to happen. And then we're trying to think of, okay, how do we solve this? And we've come up, we've been talking to the CCC, we've been talking to Lake Valley Fire, we're just racking our brains. So what we would like to do is, in May, we can get up there by boat probably, is have Lahontan come up, and the Echo Lakes Association, and ELEF, and the Forest Service, and some biologists to go up there and assess this. But what we would like to do is, for the funding that the Forest Service has to burn these piles, we would like them to use that funding to get rid of these piles. It appears that we're having the cooperation from the CCC to work with this, to hire some of their people to come in. We're talking about, do we get carts, do we get tarps, and just put these slash piles together and carry them off. And we have access to a great big boat. There's Lake Valley Fire and the CCC have slashing trucks. I don't know what you call it. The chipping trucks, things. So anyway, they said they could bring those. We could work on a date, take all this down, get it chipped, and haul it away. And we don't have to worry about the water quality. But also, when they've gone in on these stream beds, too, people don't walk up right next to stream beds. We're all pretty environmentally wise up there. And it's amazing just with the number of people up there doing this, the damage to the soil. So I know the Forest Service has Generation Green. We haven't talked to them about if some of their people would be available to help with this project, too. ELEF, I know, would come up with funding to help with it. I don't think that's a problem, but we'd like to be given permission to stop this project and have all this taken away. Any questions?
Mr. Sandel?
No.
Ms. Cox? I think my question would be for staff on this. I'm relatively new to learning about the timber waivers, this type of practice, but the photos that you've seen, are they consistent with the 2009 timber waiver practices?
Many of these photos you've seen would be a lack of compliance, either of the placement of the piles, the size of the piles, or the potential discharge of earth, sawdust, ash to a surface water, which would also be in violation of General Condition Number 2 of the existing 2009 waiver and also of the proposed waiver. So, yes, there are things here that we see that would not be compliant with the timber waiver. A staff person did go up and evaluate this area early last fall, and granted, could not walk every inch of ground out there, did not see violations at that time. The project continued after her inspection. And I'm seeing stuff here that would not be in compliance with the temporary.
So
either in a direct violation or a potential violation.
So what would occur if you went up and inspected now and saw piles that were representative of what the photograph shows? What would our next steps be?
We would
We have an agreement with the Forest Service to work things out at the very lowest level possible. So it would either be a verbal communication from staff to Forest Service staff. We could also proceed. So verbal communication, a staff enforcement letter, a notice to comply, which is an official water board enforcement tool. These are all very low-level enforcement mechanisms. Ideally, the Forest Service would respond appropriately, and it could be resolved at that level. If things do not get resolved at a lower level, it would ramp up. There's progressive enforcement policy that we would engage in to rectify the situation.
It seems reasonable to remediate the problem at this point, future eliminate additional issues and pop up. It's the lowest common denominator here. Thank you. Mr. Jordan?
No questions right now. I've been up there a little bit, so
yeah.
I'm somewhat familiar with soil conditions or rock conditions.
And that's another issue, is why did the thinning even occur? Because there's been, you know, sure you get a lightning strike once in a while, but it burns on a tree. This is so full of granite slab that it's not conducive to a big wildfire. And then that's another concern of ours, is the outcome-based approach, where they're monitoring themselves, and I look at what's happened here, and we've had dialogue going back and forth, and nothing seems to happen.
Mr. Pumphrey?
I don't have any questions. I have some comments, and I don't know if they're appropriate now.
They are appropriate now.
This is a perfect example. Well, it's not perfect, but it is an example of the point, I think, that I took from the chair's comments regarding this question of reliance on the project implementation people. In truth and in fact, if you engage in the kind of process that brings forth this particular proposed waiver, where you engage stakeholders, where you try to collaborate, where you do in fact collaborate, it's not just everybody's relying on everybody else, and so it's not just a reliance on the implementators. The implementation people have to rely on the agency people to try to go through and speak to the issues that were raised earlier by the Forest Service about, are there other ways to do things? Are there ways we can learn from our experience and be more cost and time effective? Because other stakeholders have to know that they're being relied upon to bring issues to people's attention. And so nobody's going to walk away from this process. You're all hooked together now, and since we're part, board members are part of, we're all hooked together, that's what I'm trying to say. I would hope that there can be some follow-up discussion on site, and I can't imagine that there's not going to be. And so I'm looking forward to hearing the results of that discussion and where this process of mutual reliance can take us as we go forward, because part of what I'm hearing here is two things. I'm hearing that conceptually the framework that the proposed waiver would create could allow all of the parties and all of the stakeholders to sort of maximize their interests within the next 5 years operating under this new waiver and the concept of performance-based conversations rather than prescriptive ones. On the other hand, it might not allow for that, and the only thing that the check and balance on that is the diligence of the people involved in taking advantage of the process. So if the process seems, as outlined in the new waiver, seems to be positive and beneficial, it's really in the interest of all of the people who came together to create that waiver to make sure that they're diligent
and making the waiver work, rather than having to go backwards 5 years from now and say, no, we have to take a prescriptive approach because this reliance did not come to fruition. So it's interesting to me, and a little unexpected, I guess, that even before we've taken action one way or another on the waiver, we have an example of the kind of issue that's going to have to be worked through as part of the way this waiver gets implemented. And so we're going to start tussling. I'd like to hope that the staff will take from this, even before we've taken action on the waiver, the notion of getting together with the folks at this location and continuing to look at other locations like Saxon Creek, where maybe you could do other things. People really need to know what everybody else is thinking. They need to point at specific piles and say, does this work? If it doesn't, how did it get here? How can we make sure it doesn't happen again? So I'm always fond of the concept of the double-edged sword, because double-edged swords are potentially quite productive as tools and implements, and they're also really dangerous, because if you're on the wrong side of the edge, you can get burned by this. And so I see this waiver as exactly that. It's an opportunity to do a lot more beneficial things than might have been possible in the past, and to do them more effectively. It's also, though, it's an opportunity for collaboration to not bear fruit if the collaborators don't continue to work together. So I would hope that would happen. And it's a perfect way to start.
Amy, I wonder if we could hear from the Forest Service on this.
Does the Forest Service want to respond about the FOA's presentation?
Yeah, I want to thank the homeowners for bringing this to my attention. And the Upper Echo Lakes has been a fairly lengthy trial and tribulation over how to best manage fuel in a very remote, inaccessible kind of area. I was just chatting with Duncan. We have approximately 150 piles in that area. The interesting thing about fuels is they're not going to go away on their own unless they burn in ways that are either planned or unplanned. And so you have sort of this geographic constraint over, you cut it down and it's got to go somewhere. And there are streams, there's glacial polish, there's other stands. There are impacts just in the home, you know, the nature of the homeowner development up there. There are 196 cabins, so when you talk about impacts to the area, there's quite a sizable human impact to the area as well. An aside, too, is this is being litigated. So there will be outcomes that go beyond my ability to collaborate as much as I wish to do that, just on the basis of a litigation that is underway. So, our intention is certainly to continue working with homeowners, which we have very diligently. The project lead on this is Brian Garrett. We have all sorts of documented evidence of all the homeowners we've spoken with. Each one weighs in a little differently about which tree should go and which should stay. And those are costs. We're going to extraordinary means to connect with homeowners, but they don't all agree. And there are times that a tree is taken because it's a hazard tree. There are times that there's a proximity to one of the cabin structures that makes, it's not like you can cut it in. It sort of walks away on its own. It sort of lives where it's felled, and the brush is there, and you can move it around to some degree. But we are constrained by a whole lot. In a lot of the photos, it's interesting to note how much dead and standing is still around. I know we were focused on piles, but when I look at piles, I'm looking at, well, where did the piles come from? What was the stand that was being thinned? What was the prescription that was going into that thinning? Why here? Why now? That kind of thing. So, it, you know, this is never that linear. It's never that easy. It's a combination of adjusting every which way, every second of the day. And so I know that in most cases we were using force account, meaning our in-house employees, but even in-house employees are not, you know, we don't usually use our civil culturists to stack wood. So, you know, the piles were created with fire crews, and there are some piles that we know we have concerns with that Brian has already agreed to move. I don't know if they are these specific ones, so I would have to check with him on that. But, you know, that's pretty much my response. It's a dynamic environment.
Thank you. Just a second. I have to manage this meeting here. Do you have a short response, Mr. Cushman?
Yes. Primarily to
make it short, please.
Mr. Pumphrey's question
okay.
of how do we make a performance-based approach more effective and reasonable. We have 2.5 person years, PYs, for the entire Lahontan region from Oregon to the Mojave on the East Slope. That's not many people. Some of that goes to overhead and administrative costs. We don't have the staff to go look at every project. One of the revisions that was brought into this timber waiver is a shift in the monitoring program to every project shall have monitoring reports conducted, getting away from the previous approach of the U.S. Forest Service BMP-EP, Best Management Practice Evaluation Program, that looked at a small subset of projects. So ideally, we would capture this sort of non-compliance would be captured in the monitoring reports, would be submitted on a project level to address piles, roads, landings. So we are hopeful that by making that transition in the proposed waiver, we would be better able to capture this sort of stuff and ensure compliance and recognize where it's not happening and be able to collaborate on how to rectify problems. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to move along. First of all, I'd like to say I think it's so wonderful how much everybody cares about this lake. I mean, I think that's really where we're all coming from in this room, and it's wonderful. For the residents of Echo Lake, when you hear from the Forest Service that they are concerned about managing a bundle of different risks, and, you know, the risk of catastrophic fire in your community is one of the risks that they're concerned about. So, you know, I mean, I understand looking at what you see up there and having some concerns, but I would ask you as you look at them to think about what would you propose instead. And I haven't heard anything. What I've heard from you is, following on what Ms. Cox raised, the question is more, is this compliance with the existing waiver, as opposed to you're asking for, I don't hear you asking for changes in the waiver that's in front of us to be proposed. So the other thing I would say, are you familiar with the work of Dr. Alan Turner? This goes to your comment about whether the soils are accustomed to absorbing the carbon and nutrients from the burn. But he's done extensive fire restoration work in Meeks Creek. And, I mean, so, no, there hasn't been this history of slash pile burning up there since the Forest Service, the Basin Management Unit, has been existing. But going back before Euro-Americans, whatever term you want to use, were here, there was lots of burning in this basin. And, of course, less up at the higher elevations, and most of the higher elevations were lightning strikes that tended to burn out after, but they're historic, you know, I mean, there is a record of fire disturbance in the basin, that's, so the soils have had exposure to those outputs from fire before. It sounds to me like a lot more conversation has to happen between your group and the Forest Service. It doesn't really involve the Lahontan board other than if there's an enforcement issue, which can be looked at. I think that's all that I have to say. We have one more comment card who promises to be really quick. Lisa Murphy, you say you will take only 2 minutes.
My name is Lisa Murphy, and I'm also here with concern for this Echo Lake environment, and thank you. And I basically just want to say that my experience of watching this through the process and participating in some of the meetings is that I feel like the Lahontan Water Board has been genuinely interested in stakeholder input and in its regulatory capacity to ensure that we do the best for the Tahoe Basin and water clarity. And I definitely do believe that, you know, Lahontan's involvement in this circumstance up there is, you know, a key aspect of us protecting Tahoe as well as Echo. So thank you very much for being a board and a employees of the Water Board that really encouraged me in the process.
Thank you. Any other board comments or questions? Do I hear a motion?
I would move that adoption of the conditional waiver with the last submitted set of corrections and editorial change.
I'll second that.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Motion carries. And with that, I think we have concluded this meeting. Any other business for this meeting? Thank you, everyone, for coming. We appreciate your comments.